I once took a photograph of a Shipibo shaman in the rainforest of the Peruvian Amazon. He was holding a small glass jar containing a dark reddish-brown liquid close to his lips. When I returned home and examined the photo, I was amazed at what I saw in the image. While the glass jar was in perfect focus, the shaman holding it was but a blur. This leads me to ask, what was in that glass jug and what was in that shaman?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 521st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or, hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Pucallpa who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer David on the boards and Carol Stafford on the phones. Folks, the Amazon Basin is one of the last places on Earth where you can still find cultures living in pure, dirty nature. It is tempting for those of us who fly into the basin from the civilized world to see the indigenous cultures as being, well, a little backwards, I guess. But if we take the time to learn how those cultures live with nature, we can begin to see that there is intelligence everywhere we look. And this leads us to ask today, what kind of intelligence can one find in the pure, dirty nature of the Amazon rainforest? And who better to ask but Jeremy Narby, who is the author of The Cosmic Serpent. Jeremy, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi.
So you're also, in addition to being the author of The Cosmic Serpent, you're working with an environmental organization that works out of the Amazon rainforest, correct?
Well, it works out of Switzerland, and it backs a local project in 20 southern countries in Asia, Africa, and South America, mm-hmm. And I run the Amazonian projects part.
Well, what kind of projects do you do?
Well, I don't do what it is I listen to the indigenous organizations of the Amazon Basin and see what they propose. 16 years ago when I started, what they were proposing was to demarcate their own territories and get the governments of the countries in which they find themselves to recognize their ownership of their territories. So concretely, that came down to raising funds here in Europe to pay the salaries of the employees of the Ministry of Agriculture in Peru, for example, to simply go out and enact their own constitution. The Peruvian constitution said, mm-hmm. Indigenous Amazonian people have a right to own their territories. The excuse for never doing this legal work was that there was no money. So the indigenous organizations had the political will, and we found money, and then we got the job done. But the actual work was done by the indigenous people on the ground and the Peruvian bureaucrats.
And the significance of that, of course, is that once the indigenous people have title to their land, they can actually protect it or sell it off or do whatever they want.
Well, see, actually, no. Once the Peruvian legislation says that they can't sell it unless two-thirds of the members of the indigenous community agree to dissolve the community and sell the lands, and to my knowledge, this has never happened.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, just returning to your question, after a series of land titling projects happened with successful results, and so then the people started actually owning their lands with official bits of paper that recognized their ownership, then the people said, well, what we'd like now is to have, for example, recognition of our systems of knowledge. And so instead of sending our kids to primary schools where they learn Spanish and, let's say, Western knowledge, we would like bilingual intercultural education for our children, because otherwise they forget mm-hmm. Everything that they know. You know, concretely, we'd be talking about Shipibo kids, 8 years old, who would go and sit in a schoolroom normally they are part of an oral culture where you learn by hanging out with your parents and doing things in the rainforest, learning
sure.
about the plants and the animals. There they'd be sitting in a schoolroom, enclosed in a small hut with words on paper in Spanish talking about conquistadors and elephants in Africa. Nothing to do with their local reality. So at that point, the indigenous organizations of the Peruvian Amazon started asking for funds for bilingual intercultural education programs. And so each time they take the lead in proposing what kind of project they'd like to see funded.
When you say bilingual, it's almost bicultural as well, is it not?
Yes, bilingual, learning about, intercultural.
Yeah, they're so learning about the outside world, but they're also learning about their world. Is that what you're saying?
Well, it would be like you'd have your average Western education where you learn how to count, where you learn how to read with, A, B, C, D, E, F, G in Spanish. But you would also learn how to speak your mother tongue, like Shipibo, for example. And you would also learn the myths of your tribe and how to make a trap for fish and, essentially what your...
What it takes to get by in the rainforest.
Yeah.
What it takes to survive there.
Yeah.
Because...
And actually there's a lot of knowledge just in the local culture, what you were saying at the beginning. So there are people who know how to live in dirty nature. But actually living out in dirty nature...
Is that an unfair description of nature?
Well, it's true that it's
dirty nature, right? It's not clean, it's dirty, it's filled with life.
Exactly, it's teeming. And meanwhile, I think that's one of the things that these people who live out in the rainforest know, is that living in the rainforest is a tricky business, and any animal, any bug, insect, worm, plant that can figure out how to make a living in the rainforest and get by... has got to be pretty sharp.
Ooh,
they don't look at what's around them as just a bunch of dumb plants and dumb animals. Actually, the question is, you have to be a pretty smart human if you want to avoid being eaten by animals and poisoned
or bugs
by plants
or anything else. Yeah,
So there's just a very matter of fact kind of respect for other life forms. Which is a form of intelligence, the kind of Western view where you just look out at nature as being devoid of sentience and just a product there, a stupid bunch of resources for us to exploit, is not only arrogant, but actually fairly stupid in that it's wrong. You know, that when you actually take the time to pause and look at what a single amoeba can do, you'd actually be surprised.
And that's, of course, where we want to go with this program, and I'd like to lead it off by telling a story of something that happened to me down in the rainforest. But before we go there, I want to ask you about the cosmic serpent, because it does have a lot to do with what we're about to talk about today, the intelligence of plants and animals and people. What is the cosmic serpent?
Well, it's a book I wrote with that title, but it's also a mythological figure. So, you want me to talk about?
Let's start with a mythological figure, and then bring it up to your book. Then,
okay. Well, it's one of these surprising things that if you look around the world and among Aboriginal Australians or among ancient Egyptians or the Aztecs or in the deepest Amazon, you have people who have been separated in some cases by tens of thousands of years, who come up with a similar cosmology or explanation for the origin and nature of life in the cosmos. And this figure, the cosmic serpent, is a large serpent entity that comes from the cosmos and that is associated in all these different places with the origin of life on Earth and its ongoingness.
So if it's almost a universal, where on Earth did we come up with it? Where does this symbol come from?
Well, I think that what this points to, also added to the fact that when you go into modified states of consciousness guided by an indigenous shaman in one of these out-of-the-way places, people report seeing this entity. So it's not exactly as if it was only our ancestors a very long time ago who kind of dreamed it up in Australia and the Amazon. It seems to be a kind of reality that we can access in the antipodes of our minds.
Well, let's hold that right there, hold that thought, and when we get back, we'll tell a little story. And perhaps Jeremy can help us out by interpreting it with respect to the cosmic serpent. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We've got Jeremy Narby live today from Switzerland. He's the author of The Cosmic Serpent and a worker in the Amazon. He helps the indigenous peoples of the Amazon develop their cultures, develop ways to stay alive in our civilized world as well. We will be right back after these messages, so please do stay tuned. Water users, you can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and get rid of calcium carbonate deposits, no, not by magic, by installing an Aquamax catalytic converter in your water line that will induce epitaxial nucleation. Listen.
My name is Dave. I'm from Las Vegas, Nevada. Well, my pool maintenance is virtually none. There's no scale buildup on the tile whatsoever. I just take a damp cloth every so often and wipe the tile down, and that's as much work as I have to do. I don't have to aerate my lawn at all now. I just fertilize once in the spring and once in the fall, and that pretty much maintains my lawn.
You can reduce your need for water by 30% and more, grow healthier plants, and eliminate calcium carbonate deposits just by installing an Aquamax on your water line. No chemicals, no filters. Explore the possibility. Go to metrofarm.com, click on the Aquamax Water Saver banner, and save. That's metrofarm.com. Well, we're back. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jeremy Narby, author of The Cosmic Serpent, coming to you live today from, recorded, I guess, from Switzerland. We're talking a little bit about the intelligence of life in the rainforest of the Amazon and perhaps looking at this intelligence in ways that we here in the West or in civilized world are not accustomed to doing. Jeremy, I have a little story that happened to me down in the Amazon. Perhaps you could help us out with it. I was pretty much the naive tourist, unlike you, who have been down there many times. This was my first time down there, and this group took me down there and to visit with the Shipibo people, and we motored back on the Rio Ucayali for quite a while, and come to their villages, and we spent time at different villages of the Shipibo people. But on one of these visits, we had the opportunity to go for a nature walk with a shaman out into the rainforest, and he was showing us some of the medicinal herbs that they use to stay alive in the jungles. And for example, he was showing us the sangre de drago and the uña de gato and vines and whatnot. And as we paused at one of these herbs and he was talking, he suddenly pulled out a jug of this real earthy-looking jungle juice, I guess it was. He called it ayahuasca and offered it around to the group. And I thought it was the Masato that we had been drinking, which is just a kind of jungle beer. And I had a couple good slugs of it, but it certainly didn't taste like Masato. And so I asked my host what on earth I had just consumed, and he said, well, ayahuasca is something that allows you to see nature in ways that you've never seen it before. And I thought, well, uh-oh, what is this?
Right.
But we were walking along, and so I asked myself, am I seeing things differently than I've seen them before? And I thought, well, how can I possibly know? I've never been in the Amazon before. But then we stopped at another herb, and I was kind of hanging from a vine, you know, I was kind of had my hand up there resting on a vine, and all of a sudden I felt this very sharp pain, and it was just real sharp, and I looked up and there was a little ant up there, and the funniest thing happened with my eyesight. I just telescoped right in on that ant, and it started talking to him, and the first thing he said to me was, hey, put that finger back up here. That was delicious. And I looked at him, and I thought, no, this can't be happening to me. And I said, I'm not putting my finger back up there. And I had this kind of a conversation with an ant, and I could see him so clearly. I could see his antenna moving and him looking at me and pleading for me to put my finger back up there. And I got to thinking, this is the strangest thing I've ever experienced. And I started looking around, and I realized that, you know, everything in that jungle has this incredible intelligence, an intelligence that I really never recognized before. And not only were they intelligent, but I was probably the dumbest thing in the jungle at that time, because the knowledge that I had acquired over the years had absolutely nothing to do with that dirty nature that I was in. And my chances of surviving in that food chain without the good graces of my shaman host was probably not very good. So do plants and animals have that kind of intelligence that I thought they had, or was I simply hallucinating?
Well, Michael, I'd say that you were right on the money there. In fact, I wouldn't really have too much to add to what you said, and we could just end the show there.
I thought it was hallucinating, you know what I mean?
Well,
I was talking with an ant.
Right. Michael Olson's talking with the ants again.
Uh-huh.
That's how it is, at least. Look, this is the really intriguing and really funny thing, because what you just said is how the indigenous people in the Amazon understand it. What they say is that our eyes deceive us. And if we're just in an ordinary state of consciousness looking at plants and animals, they don't talk to us. They seem dumb in the sense that they don't communicate. And, you know, there it is. But actually, this is a deception. And under the surface of that surface reality, they are also human like us. We're members of the same family. And actually, what ayahuasca and tobacco and these other psychoactive plants are, they're not hallucinogens or entheogens. They are means of transcending the barrier between species and, in modified states of consciousness, communicating with these other species. Mm-hmm. That's what shamans do. And you can learn all kinds of things, they say, in these trance conversations with, for example, ants. This is you'll see, if you look at the anthropological literature on indigenous ayahuasca use, you have all kinds of people who report conversations about ants. You know, don't go thinking you're the first person in the world ever to have spoken with an ant. Now, but this is also where it's epistemologically interesting. That means, according to different theories of knowledge, rational scientific knowledge stops at, it does not include hallucination. In other words, one of the limits of objective knowledge, or knowledge that claims to be objective, is that it does not recognize as valid, modified states of consciousness.
So in other words,
by definition, if you hallucinate something, then it can't be true. Because, you know, to consider that there's verifiable information in your hallucinations is the definition of psychosis, according to rational knowledge. So then there's this problem.
So what you're saying, Jeremy, is that if one induces this conversation with a substance like ayahuasca, then it no longer has any validity, because...
No, I didn't say it doesn't have any validity. I say that in terms of rational knowledge, it loses its validity.
Right. Okay.
What I think the point is to open up to other ways of knowing without throwing the baby out with the bathwater. I mean, it is pretty clear that Western cultures have artificially separated humans off from the rest of nature. Even in our concepts, I mean, if you look in the dictionary under the word nature, you will find the phenomena of the physical world to the exclusion of human beings.
Mm-hmm.
The definition of nature excludes human beings. If you look at the definition of intelligence, you'll see that it excludes non-humans. the often the definition that we've given to intelligence is in exclusively human terms and by definition cannot be applied to other species. So even in our concepts, we cut ourselves off even before we start thinking.
Do we not do that out of just a way of protecting ourselves from thinking too much about it?
Hold on here, because, you know, why we do it is another can of worms
altogether. Okay,
but just in this, given that we in Western rational culture have separated ourselves off from plants and animals and put ourselves on this kind of pedestal, and our formidable rational knowledge also says that it cannot use, cannot consider as valid modified states of consciousness. On the other hand, down from the pedestal, down in the dirty Amazon, the indigenous people are saying, wait a second, it's actually possible, according to us, and actually to shamans around the world, to communicate with other species in these states of consciousness. So it would seem to me, I mean, it's not going to be tomorrow that the international scientific community is going to go gung-ho and open up to this kind of, tool, in fact. But that doesn't stop you and me from considering it.
And even experiencing it.
And actually, I find that to be a fairly scientific approach. In other words, you test things on yourself. That's pretty ethical.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you test it. Instead of calling it invalid without even trying it, which is bad science, you know, you check it out. And actually, it's surprising the number of open-minded Westerners, professional people, try this modified state of consciousness induced by ayahuasca, and a great number of them come out reporting that they've learned many things indeed.
And had conversations with ants. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jeremy Narby, and who is the author of The Cosmic Serpent. We will be right back after these messages. Please do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jeremy Narby, author of The Cosmic Serpent, coming to us today from beautiful Switzerland up in the mountains. So I bet it's really pretty up there, huh, Jeremy?
Yeah, well, and also it's just the end of the autumn here, so there's all kinds of colors.
Oh, beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about intelligence of plants and animals and perhaps seeing this intelligence in ways we've never had the opportunity to see before. Down in the Amazonian jungles of Peru, Jeremy, I don't know, have you done this ayahuasca?
Well, yeah, I've actually written about my experiences. Yeah, mm-hmm. I've done it about 20 times in 20 years.
Mm-hmm. Do you do it in the Amazon down there?
Yeah, I've only ever done it in the company of an indigenous shaman, mm-hmm, in the Peruvian Amazon.
You know, it was truly amazing to me to see them walking through the jungles barefoot and being able to live in that environment. When I ran into an ant that I was firmly convinced was all about eating me up whole, this little tiny ant. So I wonder how those people survive in that incredibly competitive environment. You know, people look at the Amazon rainforest and think it must be, you know, kind of a jungle paradise, but it's really survival of the fittest.
Right. Right. Well, once again, you're saying things just as they are. It's true that on several occasions I've been in the Amazon with some folks from Europe, or you know, and who had a very romantic vision of the forest. But you're absolutely right. There's a whole bunch of nasty critters out there, and you know, if you've actually been in the forest enough with indigenous people, you know, there have been several occasions where the group of people I was with, everybody just went silent and started walking really fast and with no explanation, because hush hush. And in fact, somebody had seen a jaguar track in the mud, and the idea was, you know, we better shut up and get out of here fast, otherwise we're going to be cat food.
Yeah.
And you know, when you feel a bunch of naked humans walking around with your juicy pink flesh, that there is a feline intelligence that's lurking and and is hungry, you know, suddenly you feel small. And it's true, there are some ants down there. If you want to talk about ants, this one kind of ant, it's called Isula. It's about three times larger than the ants that we're used to. It looks like a kind of a tank. And this thing has a sting that's so powerful that, first of all, it just makes you sit down for an hour because it just stuns you so much. The pain is all-encompassing. And then the strange thing about this ant sting is that, say it stings you on your thumb, if you then press on your thumb where the sting was for the next 3 or 4 weeks, the sharpness of the pain that occurs is almost of the same order of the original sting. So it's just like this major source of pain.
And that's just an ant. So, you know, we look at that, and another thing about that people have to really consider about the Amazon rainforest is that when things die in the Amazon rainforest, they don't stay dead for very long. You know, they keel over and fall into the forest floor, and then all of these organisms set upon it and dismantle it, and those nutrients go right back up into the canopy. They don't hang around in the soil. Things just don't die for very long.
Right. Well, meanwhile, I spent 2 years in an Ashaninka Indian community in the middle of the Peruvian Amazon. And at the end, when I was saying goodbye to these people, we had a party and so on. And I asked them whether they'd like me to stick around a little bit more, if I could be useful or something. And they said, well, you know, actually, you're a pretty lousy Indian. You know, you're a liability to us around here. In other words, we've got to keep an eye on you. You can't see the snakes when you walk, and you could get lost in the forest, and it would be dangerous. So we've looked after you for 2 years now, and it would be better if you returned to your country, you know, and went and explained to the people over there how we do things around here.
Sure.
So it's pretty clear that learning how to survive in the rainforest is a major, major task that probably most PhD students would have a hard time fulfilling.
And, you know, we're looking at these plants and these animals as having this this incredible intelligence. And I made the comment, Jeremy, that do we not ignore that intelligence, or have we not force ourselves not to see it so that we can better control it? I'm thinking of our factory farms, for example, you know, where we have 30,000 hogs penned up in a big barn.
Mm-hmm.
If we look into their eyes and see them as sentient beings, we're going to have a little trouble there, aren't we?
Yeah, but I think you're right. I think the roots to it go quite a bit deeper. Let me just run this by you. I think that about 2,500 years ago, when the Greeks got it into their minds that they wanted to measure rationally, you know, rational comes from the word ratio, to measure,
mm-hmm.
wanted to measure the world and get knowledge about it so as to control it. Well, it took about 2,000 years for rational science to really get up and running, and now we've had about 300 years of the real thing. And this kind of cold gaze, where you take nature and then you measure it and you study it and you divide it down into little bits, it's a kind of a deliberately cold gaze. It's not interested in the beauty and, well, in really the dirtiness. It wants to have a control over it, and we can see that rational science is very powerful. This is a very mm-hmm. powerful but deliberately cold gaze, and we have to pay a price for this knowledge. You know, it's led us to the understanding of the molecular nature of reality and of biology. All this is good, as well as
to factory hog farms, right?
And factory hog farms, exactly. And at the same time, the price that we've had to pay to get to this place is that we've separated ourselves off from nature, and we insist that the only valid way of understanding it is in this cold fashion. So here we have nature, plants and animals, raging with complexity, raging with intelligence, filled with DNA molecules, which actually are texts. They're chemical texts. Nature is filled with symbols. That's not a metaphor. It's literally true. I mean, it's molecularly true. So we're looking at a living, communicating phenomenon of mind-blowing complexity, and because we insist on looking at it with this cold gaze, well, we can't actually grasp its true nature. You know, we can grasp aspects of it, we can measure the molecules, but actually, it's this kind of weird thing. You know, it's like you can look at a human being as just a skin bag that emits sound, but that's not going to get you very far in understanding what that person is saying.
Right. You know that while in the rainforest of the Peruvian Amazon, I was taught by the shaman that was leading us through the jungle there that if you're really clever and listen and look, plants will actually tell you what they're good for.
Yeah.
Their appearance even tells you what they're good for.
Well, see, that's actually a fairly old theory in Western cultures. It's called the doctrine of signatures, and medieval or Renaissance doctors like Paracelsus.
Jeremy, we have to take a quick break. I'm having too much fun, folks. Right back with Jeremy Norby. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
We're back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jeremy Norby, author of Cosmic Serpent, resident of Switzerland, where it's autumn and the mountains are beautiful. Boy, I bet they are. Jeremy, we're talking about the doctrine of signatures. I was told, for example, that there's a big snake down there called the Hargon that everybody is very much afraid of, and I was taught that the only antidote to a Hargon bite was from this particular plant called the Hargon Sancha, and that the Hargon Sancha looks just like the Hargon snake.
And has two little white fang kind of things coming out of its stem. Yeah, well, I was told about that as soon as I arrived in this Ashaninka community 22 years ago. The guy who went on to become my main informant told me about that. And the first time I heard that, you know, I thought, wait a second, this is superstition or it's metaphor or it's something, because it couldn't really be true that lurking behind this plant was an intelligence that was somehow connected to a reptile and that was managing to actually communicate true information to human beings. You know, the way that this Ashaninka Indian put it to me is that we know that this plant is going to cure that snake bite because this is the sign that nature sends us. And, you know, as if there's an intelligence in nature that's sending signs to people about snakes via plants. You know, now that just sounded, impossible.
To the scientific mind, it doesn't make sense at all, does it?
No, not really. But, you know, the fact is that the more you hang out with these people in the rainforest, the more you realize Well, actually, you know, what really counts is it true? Does this plant actually work against that snake bite? Well, it appears that it does. So then, of course, one could just say, oh, well, it's just coincidence, you know, that the plant happens to have two little white fangs just like the snake, and that doesn't mean anything. Well, it's always possible to dismiss things one doesn't understand as being just coincidence. But actually, if you go into a science lab, you know, as just your average kind of citizen, there's all kinds of things that you have to take on faith too, and that are hard to understand. So scientists have their working hypotheses. One actually hopes they have a lot of them. Well, indigenous people have their working hypotheses. You know, and this is something that anthropologists have spoken about, like guys like Claude Lévi-Strauss talked about this 50 years ago, that actually magic and science are on a continuum, and that they use the same mental operations. For example, the idea that two little fangs on a plant is giving a sign to us and communicating information about how to counter a snake venom, that's actually a hypothesis. It may be a magical one, but it's in testing that hypothesis that they've come up with a plant that actually is a cure to snake bites. So, you know, what is wrong with that that hypothesis? Nothing. It's generated verifiable and usable knowledge that actually saves people's lives. Mm-hmm. So, you know, why belittle it?
Well, I certainly wasn't belittling it. I was
No, I know. But
I was very curious about it. It mm-hmm. was just, you know, here's a snake, and it's one of the most poisonous snakes in the world, and if it bites you, you're dead, unless you can find a plant that looks just like the snake, and then you can...
You know, what I'm proposing is that, for example, if you hang out with, like, physicists, and they start talking about gluons and you know, these subatomic particles and stuff, I don't know what a gluon is. I'm going to have to take on faith that they know what they're talking about. Now, if with these entities that I can understand, they can actually come up with some interesting theory as to how the universe got started or whatever, well, good. But it doesn't change the fact that I don't know what a gluon is.
Right.
And I'm nowhere close to actually having a concept. So I'm willing to suspend disbelief with these physicists and let them get on with their job. Well, in the same way, when shamans have this notion that there is verifiable information to be had by looking at the shape of plants and animals, which is off the map for us, well, you know, why not?
Why not? Well, that's the question of the... Can science and shamanism, you know, live in the same world?
Well, actually, you know, the good news, I think, at least in my experience, has been there is a big difference between what you read in Science, Scientific American, and Nature. You know, the official line of the international scientific community can seem pretty dogmatic on certain questions like the ones we've been discussing here.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, when you actually go into labs and meet individual scientists, biologists, I've only met open-minded, curious scientists who are very open to dialoguing with indigenous shamans and considering them as knowledgeable people and considering that there's a lot of mystery in nature. Actually, you know, I think that quite a few scientists have a sensitivity to the magical approach.
What about the other way? What about shamans?
There it's really clear. I mean, that's I actually did this experiment in 1999 of taking three molecular biologists to spend a couple of weeks with an indigenous shaman.
Oh, hold that thought. We're going to have to take a quick break, but I can't wait to hear this story. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here with Jeremy Narby. We're talking about the intelligence of nature. And Jeremy's the author of The Cosmic Serpent, coming to us today from beautiful Switzerland. Do stay tuned right back. We're back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Jeremy Narby, who is the author of The Cosmic Serpent, and a frequent visitor to the Amazon, and we're talking about the intelligence of nature as witnessed by those who happen to travel through the Amazon and get hooked up with some shaman and get into some really interesting experiences down there. You took three molecular biologists down there. Jeremy, what happened?
Well, I actually put into writing a description of what happened at the end of an anthology I did with Francis Huxley called Shamans Through Time. It's the last chapter in that book, and it's called Scientists and Shamans. And so anybody interested in the details of
Called, Scientists and Shamans?
Yeah, that's what the chapter is called, and the book is called Shamans Through Time.
Oh, okay, good.
And well, these were geneticists who were studying plants and sperm cells and genes, human genes, and they had pretty specific questions about their research. I could maybe more profitably tell you about the problems they encountered, because essentially they all gained information about their ongoing research. They all learned things. But they all had problems with the approach, and I think there's some pretty clear methodological differences between science and ayahuasca shamanism. The first thing with ayahuasca shamanism is that it's a subjective, personal, interior experience, and one of the first things that the ayahuasca does is that it confronts you with yourself and all the things that you need to clean up inside you.
Yep.
You know, and scientists are usually not paying very much attention to themselves, because their job is to be objective. You know, they're often jettisoning the self when they actually go looking for knowledge.
It's why Albert Einstein
couldn't find it. It's all about the non-self, as far as they're concerned.
It's why Albert Einstein couldn't find his own front door, right?
Well, maybe. I didn't know about that.
we have 1 minute left, Jeremy.
Yeah, well, I think in a nutshell, it is possible to practice both science and shamanism, but it takes, they're pretty contrary methodologically, so getting good at it is like getting good at two very different languages. It takes a lot of practice. It takes time. And also institutionally, the scientific establishment is probably not ready for it. So if you practice it, keep it to yourself, you know.
Right.
Otherwise, they think you might be nuts.
You might be nuts. What can we in the civilized world take away from the ayahuasca shamanism of the rainforest?
Well, what is the civilized world you're talking about?
Good question
Well, meanwhile, you know, I think that just by listening to another point of view, a radically different point of view, it's good mental hygiene. You know, so we may have a material point of view, but admitting that other points of views are possible and just paying attention to them and trying to wrap our minds around them, that's already a step in the right direction.
Wow. Jeremy Narby, who is the author of The Cosmic Serpent. What is the name of your organization there in Switzerland?
It's called Nouvelle Planète, which means new planet in French.
And your favorite place in the Amazon?
Ooh, that's a good question. There's a place called the Sinepa Valley that I like a lot. But, you know, they're all sort of out in the sticks.
Out in the sticks. Well, we want to thank you so much for joining us. And
okay, Michael, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
You bet. Folks, stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.